Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, how podcasts may be shaping public policy, and an Arizona firefighter with a taste for the wilder side of the state. But first, when the Trump administration issued a surprising order freezing federal funding last week, many organizations who rely on that funding were stunned. One such organization was Head Start, an education and childcare program that's been running since the late 1960s. Jessica Rivera-Garcia is the executive director of the Arizona Head Start Association, and she had a front row seat to the chaos the order created before it was abruptly rescinded. I spoke with Jessica yesterday to get an inside perspective on what happened. Perhaps, like some of you, I was only familiar with Head Start in a general sense, so I began by asking her to explain the full scope of their work.
Head Start promotes school readiness for children from low-income and at-risk families. We provide early childhood education, health services, nutrition, and parent involvement opportunities to support the development of children's ages 0 to 5. We focus on helping children develop social, cognitive, and emotional skills, preparing them to be successful in school. And the program also includes support for families, such as parenting resources and connecting them with other community services.
Wow. So it's very comprehensive. It's not just focused on the kids themselves. It seems like it's a really broad-based effort.
Correct. We are a two-generation approach. We believe that helping the families be successful in their life and as well as supporting the children, we can help them both be successful and have a successful life.
And do you have an estimate of how many kids Arizona Head Start has impacted?
Yes. So we served for our 2025 Head Start profile for the state of Arizona. We provided services to around 17,000 children.
And where does Arizona Head Start get their funding from?
We receive funding from the federal government, from the Health and Human Services Department.
So that sort of leads us to the news peg for this conversation. Give us a sense of what's been going on with Head Start nationally in the last couple of weeks and what the impact has been on Arizona Head Start in particular.
Yes. So throughout the last couple of weeks, because of the funding freeze, some of our Arizona grantees experienced delayed in payments, which created a big concern.
We're talking about a period of what, about 36 hours or so? How long was it?
Yes, like you mentioned, it was around 36 hours or so that Tuesday, Wednesday before it got rescinded. So we were in constant communication with our national and regional partners, trying to make sure that we had the most updated and current information to provide to our Head Start programs. And then, of course, Head Start programs were reaching out to us, letting us know if they had any issues accessing the portal.
Yeah. So this portal that Head Start programs access to get federal funding, just to kind of give people a concrete sense of what it would have been like to work at a Head Start facility and think you're going about your normal business of the day and realize that things have been disrupted. Is it, it's just like a website that you log into and then what happens?
You log in and you're able to basically request a drawdown on how much you're requesting, and then you're supposed to get it like be approved or not of that request, and then you get the funds. So what was happening was that either the system was like the system is down, or that your request to draw funds is still processing or pending.
Right. And this is the kind of thing that presumably on a normal day, there's no hitch.
Correct. They would just have requested the funds and then it would have been approved and then they will get the funds.
Can you give us an example of the kind of impact that a family might feel if services were disrupted?
It will greatly impact, you know, their life. It can affect to a family to be able to go to work that day because they rely on our program to provide the service of, for their child while they're at work. So having to find someone something at last minute might be detrimental, and they might have to call off work because they don't have anyone that they trust to care for their child.
Yeah. I don't know if this is something you can talk about, but just to ask, I know that part of the short-lived order was related to what the president called, I believe, wokeness. Was that something that created concern in the conversations you had during that brief period where the funding was frozen?
When that happened, that was not the first thing we thought it was going to be about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the freeze happened, it was not like a correlation of like, oh, it's because of the DEI. It was more like, oh my gosh, what is happening? We need funds. Like, what, Head Start is important. Like, we need to have it. It was more of that.
I see. Well, so obviously, as you were just explaining, this was a very intense 36-hour period where there was a tremendous amount of uncertainty. The order was rescinded, but the future seems uncertain. How has this affected your long-term planning? What are you keeping an eye out for in the days and weeks ahead?
So the Head Start program has a legacy of positive outcomes, you know, including socioeconomic benefits for recipients and the community. And one of the things that we are going to keep doing is working very closely with state leaders throughout shared advocacy with our regional and community partners. I think that's one of the ways that we're going to continue working closely together, making sure that we continue expanding the awareness of, you know, what Head Start is, the positive impact that we are making in the community. So trying to make, you know, our programs be seen as what we are, which is a vital service for our community.
So the it sounds like the plan is to just make sure that the lines of communication are open and mm-hmm. the work and the impact that the work has is very clear to local stakeholders, because it seems like it's going to be difficult to make any sort of prediction about what's going to happen at the federal level.
Correct.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there for now. Jessica Rivera-Garcia is the executive director of the Arizona Head Start Association. Jessica, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
The practice of biotech companies going into underrepresented communities to study people's genetic makeup is not new. Neither, unfortunately, is the practice of those same companies taking advantage of those who share their DNA or other genetic material. That includes at least one Native American community in Arizona. A Seattle-based company, though, is looking to do things differently. Variant Bio recently announced a multi-million dollar deal with a pharmaceutical company. The New York Times reports some of that money will go to the indigenous communities with whom the firm worked across 9 countries or territories. My co-host, Mark Brody, talked about this and what it could mean going forward with Crystal Soucy, an assistant professor in ASU's School of Life Sciences. And they started with what she thinks about the Variant Bio model, especially relative to what we've seen other companies do in the past.
To be honest, the news that Variant Bio is offering some sort of profit sharing with the scientific communities that they're partnering as a form of benefit sharing is not new to Variant Bio. It's been part of their mission statement for the last few years. But the novelty is that they're really among the first pharmaceutical companies to have this type of this language in their mission statements. But also, it's surprising that no other drug companies, to my knowledge, have also similarly followed suit.
Why do you think it is that more companies haven't done that?
Oh, gosh, money. If you have people who are willing to pay $100 or more to companies, and they spit in the tube, mail it off, and get some sort of results out of that, if they're getting like double the money, like in terms of what people are willing to pay for the service, and then they're willing to also sell that data to other companies, why would they try to do the right thing? Why would they try to exercise some sort of corporate accountability in that regard? There's also the problem that in this era of open data, everyone is being encouraged to share all of their data, but nobody's questioning that industry really stands to profit in like a one-way dynamic that is not seen in other spaces.
So is there any way other than just individual companies deciding to do it differently to encourage more of what Variant Bio is doing in this space? Like, are there policy changes? Are there financial structural industry changes that could or maybe in your mind need to happen?
Oh, there needs to be a lot of structural and systemic changes. First of all, it's great that there's this positive news that's coming forward and people really responding to the Variant Bio model. And I hope that will see like other positive shifts in other companies in other spaces. The other thing is that we as researchers and people who utilize and collect data should also start taking these systems as part of our normative practices. It needs to be the new norm. And then consumers, individuals who are producers of this data should be more critically asking the question, what are those terms to which I am agreeing to when I just click through like the end user license agreements that I'm signing to unwittingly and not reading the thing? We really should be questioning more about the power of our consent and also understanding the commercial value of our, particularly our genetic data.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about the role that sort of awareness plays in all of this. It sounds like it's a pretty big component, especially on sort of the user, the producer of the data end of this.
So when I teach this in my class of undergraduate students, I first start off with an example. Think about the popular social media app that you've downloaded, and you have to click on the end user license agreement, the EULA. Like, are you actually reading the terms, or are you just scrolling through it and clicking next? And you might be okay with your data being sold to advertisers or having cookies tracking your clicks on your personal device. But then think about your DNA. And like what we're giving up in terms of the type of knowledge and surveillance that not only companies, but also perhaps governments are able to unlock this power of tracking not only all of our activities as individuals, but also tracking then also like the choices and the health statuses of everyone that we're biologically related to.
Do you see any evidence to suggest that what Variant Bio is doing is a model that is being or will soon be adopted by other companies? Like, is what they're doing causing some kind of sea change within the industry?
Oh, I don't have that type of oversight over across the industries, but I do know that this has garnered a lot of positive attention in the academic biomedical spaces, and a lot of universities are also partnered intrinsically hand in hand with corporations and industries, particularly in the space of genomics research. So again, by really pushing this as the new model, the new norm, hoping that this will come to some pivotal fundamental changes later on.
Assuming that there are other companies that either in the near term or a little bit maybe further down the road start doing what Variant Bio is doing, what does that mean? How does that impact the people who are offering up their or giving their genetic data, like especially in underrepresented communities and maybe some underserved communities? Like what might that do for them?
So let us be clear that a large amount of interest in finding novel gene variants are going to be in underrepresented communities that haven't participated in genomics research in large amounts. And also it's going to be in rare variant communities and patient advocacy groups. And there have been over the past few years, a number of these communities already asserting some grassroots power on collectivizing their patients and their families' data together. And this is really just requires a series of communities understanding that the power of discovery and actually the power of defining benefits is actually within them. And once that shift starts, I think you'll start to see a power dynamic that emerges in other spaces.
Are you seeing more of that happening where groups of people are saying, okay, we'll do this, but here's what we need to get in return. Here's some of the things that you need to do for us.
I am glad that you asked that question. There are global communities, indigenous communities within the U.S. and outside the U.S. that are really questioning, okay, what is the value of the sequence information that you're asking from us? And, you know, DNA is a commodified form of data, and there's a lot of promises about gene editing and CRISPR and also reintroducing biodiversity into monocultured spaces that really govern big industry and big agriculture. And some of this is from stewarded species from indigenous peoples, and yes, ourselves as our bodies. Also serving as this question of the global diversity contributing to population gene variation. So really becoming more savvy to the fact that the power lies within smaller communities to assert change, for tribal nations in the U.S. to utilize their sovereignty to create databases and also health research institutions to drive these types of collective efforts have been gaining foot over the last few years.
All right. That is Crystal Soucy with the ASU School of Life Sciences. Crystal, thank you so much for the conversation. I very much appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Good morning and welcome back to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a performer who has been with the heart-pounding show Stomp for 2 decades.
Well, first of all, I didn't think I'd be doing it this long.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, oh, I'm going to go to New York. I'm going to do Stomp. Then I'm going to go do Rent and I'm going to do, you know, whatever. But I fell in love with it deeply. And I'm, you know, it's a way of life for me.
But first, those of you with a wandering spirit may already know about Atlas Obscura. It's a travel company that, among other things, has an online directory where people can post guides to interesting places they've visited all over the world. And if you look at the listing of such places here in Arizona, there's one person who has posted more than anyone else, Brett Iredell. Brett is a firefighter in Flagstaff, and when he's not putting out fires, he travels all over the state documenting underappreciated historical sites and sharing their curious backstories. And when I spoke to Brett recently, I discovered that he himself has an interesting backstory. He's not just any firefighter. He's a wildland firefighter.
We are firefighters, but specifically we are trained and dispatched to wildfires rather than perhaps structure fires or medical incidents like your standard, what most people would conceive of as a firefighter.
Got it. Okay. So you do this wildland firefighting, which is interesting in its own right. But the thing I'm really interested to talk to you about is you have added all of these fascinating Arizona locations to the map of places that folks can explore via Atlas Obscura. I wanted to ask you about a couple of them specifically, because I've only lived here for about a year, so I'm still looking for interesting new places to go. And some of the places that you have found are totally intriguing to me. One of them is the Mayhew Lodge.
Oh, yes. I bought a book on kind of the history of Flagstaff and the surrounding area. And they mentioned a early Flagstaff figure, Jesse Jefferson Bear Howard, who made his living as a bear hunter in Oak Creek Canyon after his friend was mauled to death by a bear in the canyon.
Oh,
and
God.
At the time, Arizona still had grizzly bears. Bear Howard, as he was known, did the unfortunate work of making sure Arizona did not have grizzly bears anymore. And he built a cabin in Oak Creek Canyon. And it went through several other owners. It became kind of a resort property. And
well, yeah, but before we get to that, let's go back to Bear Howard for a second. Do we know, did he just kind of take this
grizzly bear mitigation operation upon himself? Did somebody ask him to do this?
He seemed to just get into that to avenge his friend. He just had a mission of vengeance.
Wow. And one of the amazing details that you share in the post you made about this is that he hunted bears armed with only a knife?
That's the legend. I don't know how true it was or how often that's how he went out, but
it's a good legend.
That was the word about him.
Okay, so another one that you've added to the Atlas Obscura directory that I was very fascinated by is the grave of Johnny Ringo.
Yeah, people may remember Johnny Ringo as a character from the movie Tombstone, played by Michael Biehn. He was kind of a cattle rustling outlaw, but I guess was fairly charismatic. He was alleged to have quoted Shakespeare, and I guess he was a little more well-read than most of the cattle rustlers and highway bandits.
I don't think of cattle rustlers wandering across the prairie, wondering whether they're a quintessence of dust. Although, I don't know, they're probably around dust a lot.
Right. and his death is still a mystery. I guess he's probably committed suicide, but there's some mystery in that. And a local rancher found the body, leaned up against a tree, and he's to this day buried on that private property down in southeast Arizona. You can visit his grave. The property owners let you stay on a little path and go check out the grave and historic marker.
What does the grave look like?
It's mostly a mound of rocks. I'm not sure what was added to it over the years. There's an obelisk and a gravestone with his name and date of death carved into it. It's mostly a mound of boulders that were probably found in the vicinity of his body.
Okay, and then the last one I want to ask you about is El Camino del Diablo.
Right, so El Camino del Diablo was a trail going back hundreds of years across the very arid southwestern Arizona desert. It was a very treacherous route, sometimes days of walking between water sources, and it's estimated that over 2,000 people have died crossing this trail.
Oh my God.
It was the most direct way to get to Yuma from the east until the railroads were built. So it goes back, you know, hundreds, thousands of years before Europeans arrived.
And you hiked this trail?
I hiked part of it, but I just did a day trip of it.
Hiked out
and then returned to my vehicle.
So, I mean, I know all of the places that you are drawn to are not like this, but something that these three places we've been talking about sort of have in common is just a little tinge of the macabre. And I wonder, is that something that you feel drawn to as an explorer? Because, I mean, you know, it seems like there's maybe a little bit of a connection between that and doing the work that you do, which seems like it could get somewhat harrowing from time to time.
You know, I hadn't thought about that before. Maybe that's something I would have to speak to a therapist about.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. But, I mean, I'm partially asking this because not long ago I spoke to a guy named Richard Grant, who wrote a book about Arizona called A Race to the Bottom of Crazy. I don't know if you're familiar with that book, but I think it would be up your alley based on the writing that you've done. And one of the things that he talks about in that book is that Arizona is many things, but among them, it is a haven for the Johnny Ringo cowboy rustler poet types, also the bear howl types, the person who's like, we got a bear problem in Arizona. I am going to go there myself with just a knife and solve it. It's going to be me. I'm the guy. and not to put you in the same category as those guys or to call you crazy, to be clear. But it does strike me also that, you know, particularly right now, wildfires are in the news, and there is this quality amongst most people that you talk to about fires of just kind of throwing up their hands like, ah, what a scary problem. I don't know what we're going to do about it. And you are somebody who is like, no, I'm going to go put out those fires. I'm going to be the guy. Do you see any like of yourself in the Johnny Ringos and bear howls of the world?
Well, I hope not too much in regarding maybe Johnny Ringo.
Yes, again, to be clear, you are not a criminal. No malfeasance alleged.
Right. I mean, we are facing a pretty catastrophic wildfire future unless we take some pretty large actions regarding a lot more prescribed fire. People are going to have to accept a lot more smoke maybe than they're used to. And just, you know, uncomfortable solutions, or else catastrophic wildfires are going to rise. And maybe accepting that kind of unconventional daring is part of that.
Yeah. All right. Well, Brett Iredell is a wildland firefighter with the Forest Service, and he also tops the leaderboard on Atlas Obscura for folks who have visited, added, and edited entries on interesting places in Arizona, though he's also done that in a bunch of other states. Brett, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman. Sometimes the connections we make between disparate things are less than obvious. For our next guest, the connection between algae and society seemed innate when she looked at the microorganisms through a microscope. Deborah Edgerton is an artist and assistant professor in the School of Art at Northern Arizona University. Her newest collection of work is called Life Extended: Biology as a Metaphor, and it's on display now at the Museum of Northern Arizona. The idea to look more closely at algae came from a previous exhibition she had done looking at water in the Southwest. For that, she traveled to Fossil Creek with her mentor on the project, NAU biology professor Jane Marks, and learned about algae and microorganisms in the water there. At the same time, her husband runs a lab at NAU specializing in algae. So they collected samples from the creek and brought them back to her husband's lab to look at under a microscope. And what she found turned in to art. Here's her conversation with my co-host, Lauren Gilger.
He pretty much set up the slides, and then I'd sit next to him, mm-hmm. and we'd look through, and when I saw images that I liked, then I'd stop him, and we'd shoot images and downloaded them, and then I would have like a folder full of images of algae and microorganisms and diatoms.
Yeah. So the images themselves, like, you can see that in them, but they're more abstract than that. Like, how did you approach painting them? Like, did you want them to look like what they were, or were you trying to make them something a little bit outside of that?
Well, part of that had to do with the microscope that we were using and the computer that was set up. Mm-hmm. The images aren't as clear, but I get a better range of color. Mm. So I start with images that are already a little bit vague.
Sure.
And then interpret that in terms of how I want to use color.
Yeah, yeah. This is not the first time you've done work about water. And you said, though, this exhibition, this particular body of work, is about the life within the water, which I think is such a beautiful way of putting this, because you're looking at it literally through a microscope.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, when I first started doing work related to water, I was looking at the idea of power of water. Mm-hmm. Back in 2005, which was Hurricane Katrina, I was really fascinated by the idea of what water could do and man trying to corral water and, you know, what happens when nature takes over. And then in 2011, I had an internship in Osaka, Japan. And right before the internship, the tsunami happened. Mm-hmm. The Fukushima disaster happened. Mm-hmm. And I had the choice of either going or deferring. And so I wanted to go. I wanted to see what was happening in that area, what happens when water, you know, hits land, and what kind of devastation happens. So I was doing a whole body of work in terms of the idea of the power of water. But when I started the first iteration of Life Extended, I decided that I wanted to look at it from the perspective of what was in water. And we had been visiting, you know, areas of the reservation at the time also, and the indigenous people always talk about water as life. And so yeah. I thought, I should be looking at what is in water and what can be maintained and what that could do in terms of life form.
That's really interesting. So, okay, so you're taking this a step farther here, right? Like you're not just painting these microscopic slides of algae. You're also trying to connect the dots between what you saw with these microorganisms, like relating to each other on these slides, and making connections to how people do that between races and identities. Talk a little bit about that. Connect the dots for us. Where did you see those connections?
Well, as I mentioned before, I had collected, you know, a folder full of images of algae and diatom, and I was really looking at the algae itself. But part of the bodies of work that I also do are that they relate to cultural identity, my own identity, because I'm half African American and half Japanese American.
Yeah.
So I'm always looking at this idea of the dissimilar, and then what we can look at to pull things together.
Hmm.
So I had I have a body of work that relates to both my cultures, and then I was doing this other body of work that related to water. So as I was going through images under the microscope, I found this one singular image of a Sambella diatom, and diatoms are single cell algae.
Okay.
So I was looking at this particular image, and it was like my aha moment. It reminded me of looking at those old diagrams of the overview of slave ships, you know, the shape and configuration of it. And it was like the first time I was able to look at this and see this connection of I could connect my own identity with this idea of life in water. So Jane gave me a book on ecology, and she talked about this idea of relationships, you know, in freshwater ecosystems. They have different ways of interaction. So there were like four different definitions. And when I was looking at those definitions, I thought, well, this seems like you could use this in terms of relationships between humans.
So you're looking at these things that seem opposing, right? Kind of like the diatom and the algae, but they come together. Like it's making those connections between things that you might assume didn't have anything to do with one another.
Exactly. And I really wanted to start with something that seemed like we were working together. So I took the definition of mutualism, which is where both species benefit, and I looked for a point in history that I thought that there could be this partnership where both sides would benefit from working together. And that's how I got to the Emancipation Proclamation.
Let me ask you lastly about, I guess, the takeaway you want people to get from this when they see it. Like, art shows are always subjective. Art is meant to be, I think, in some ways, subjective. But when people come to this and they read the explanations, they see the art, what do you hope they learn, they process?
You know, all of the imagery is related to algae and diatoms under the microscope. So I hope that they look at the imagery, look at some of the comments that it will be up on the text walls, and see that we're not really that different from microorganisms. You know, the organisms are doing it in an organic way in terms of survival. You know, they innately understand what they need to be paired with to get the results that they need for survival.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that they'll look at these microscopic images and then be able to translate it to their own lives. Even though I'm talking specifically about a point in time that relates to my own history, I'm hoping that anybody who comes in can look at their history and their interactions, whether it's on a global scale or on a personal level, and see that these interactions can either work positively or negatively, depending on your perspective.
Depending on your perspective, yeah.
I do hope that they can, you know, that they can slowly start seeing that bridge that I see.
Yeah, that's a beautiful one. All right. Deborah Edgerton, artist and assistant professor in the School of Art at NAU, joining us to talk about her new exhibition. Deborah, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for explaining this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yesterday, in his latest round of executive actions, President Trump issued an order intended to block trans women from competing in women's sports. The ban, officially titled the No Men in Women's Sports Executive Order, reverses guidance from the Biden administration on enforcement of Title IX. Title IX was designed to prevent sex-based discrimination in education programs that receive federal money. And under former President Biden, those programs were explicitly directed to recognize the gender identity of trans athletes. Technically, that meant that a person assigned male gender at birth, who now identifies as female, could go out for a women's sports team, and that her school couldn't prevent her from doing so. That scenario, however, is vanishingly rare. Late last year, during a hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, the president of the NCAA, Charlie Baker, was asked how many trans athletes were currently in competition at the collegiate level. Less than 10, Baker replied. Which means that, at least when it comes to college sports, yesterday's order from the White House will impact approximately 0.002% of athletes. If you agree with the president that trans women in sports are a problem, it seems fair to wonder why he's so preoccupied with such a tiny problem. The No Men in Women's Sports executive order is actually Trump's third order targeting trans people, who, according to a 2024 Gallup survey, comprise about 1% of the American adult population. Nevertheless, Trump's focus on gender is popular. When the AP polled voters last fall, more than half of them said support for trans people in society has, quote, gone too far. Trump, it would seem, has a legitimate claim that gender is on people's minds. But why? Part of the answer is podcasts.
We sat down with 2 years of videos from 9 different streamers and podcasters.
That is Leon Yin, a reporter for Bloomberg News. And back in January, he and some fellow reporters published an in-depth analysis of what's often called the manosphere, a wide range of online talk shows hosted by men with audiences in the tens of millions. Leon and his team picked 9 of the most popular of these shows: Joe Rogan, Lex Fridman, a group that calls themselves the Nelk Boys. And they listened to every minute of every episode that they released from November 2022 to November 2024. Many of these episodes are 2 or 3 hours long.
We watched, you know, definitely hundreds of hours of these videos at least.
And when they were done, they put together a pretty remarkable piece for Bloomberg that provides forensic evidence for a claim you've probably heard a few times over the last few months, that 2024 was the podcast election. Now, one of my most enduring memories of the last election cycle is sitting here in the KJZZ newsroom after Kamala Harris appeared on the Call Her Daddy podcast. That morning, there were 3 separate live cable news feeds, MSNBC, Fox, CNN, showing graphics explaining what a podcast is. And I remember thinking that Call Her Daddy, which by some accounts gets 10 million listens per episode, probably had more people tuning in to that Harris interview than all 3 of those cable networks combined that day. But the bigger narrative is the number of people who listened to Donald Trump on podcasts. Trump's appearance on Joe Rogan's show alone drew an audience of 50 million on YouTube. Trump appeared on all 9 of the podcasts that Bloomberg studied, generating more than 100 million listens. And what's remarkable about Trump's appearances on these shows is that they're a very different version of Trump than the one we see at his rallies or his interviews with traditional news organizations. He doesn't talk as much. Instead, he spends a lot of time listening to what the hosts want to talk about.
And much of what they discuss, you know, is not politics. They talk about sports, about pranks, about internet culture. Where the politics come in is when they kind of discuss the kind of social hierarchy in which American men are placed. And so it's just more conducive to kind of the like challenger mindset, right? The underdog, the fallen man. And the person who embodies that the most is Trump. So he shows up, he discusses everything, and he comes across as, you know, genuine, one of the guys, and someone who has answers and authority in the problems that are facing young men.
So how does all this rapping with the boys translate into a series of executive orders focusing on a tiny percentage of the population? Well, Leon and his team broke down every podcast episode they studied by subject, and they found that when the boys get political, they gave a roughly equal number of hours to six issues: immigration, medicine, the economy, war, voting, and transgender identity.
Boys, I know a lot of you guys are thinking like me. You're seeing what's happening in this country. Everything's just getting really, really weird. You got men playing in women's sports. This election might be...
The way they described gender transition as life-saving medical care in order to get insurance for it.
Biological men competing in women's sports is something most people think is crazy.
So millions of men spent hundreds of hours listening to their heroes put gender anxiety on the same pedestal as election integrity, healthcare, and war. Leon's analysis helps explain why Trump is now doing the same thing.
Watching all of this is very confusing. Likely many people, many of the listeners that they have probably have never met a trans person or like had someone that transitioned in their life.
You guys watched over 2,000 videos for this project. How many episodes had a trans person as a guest?
There are only a few transgender guests that occur, and some of them are there to basically be kind of like, I detransitioned, and it kind of ruined my life. It'll ruin your life too. And so they're kind of tokenized in a way. They kind of use this person as a kind of scarecrow.
Good morning. This is The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman, along with Mark Brody.
Even if you've never seen a performance of Stomp, you may have heard one. The group has been putting on stage shows for more than three decades, using trash cans, oil drums, brooms, and other common items to make music. They'll be performing Friday and Saturday at Chandler Center for the Arts as part of their current tour. Andrew Patrick is a performer with Stomp and resident director for the North American tour. He's also been a part of the group for 23 years. I spoke with him earlier and asked at what point he realized this was something he wanted to do with his life.
Well, my mom actually bought me tickets to see Stomp in Providence, Rhode Island when I was like 17 years old. And I went to see it with one of my best friends. And, I was really blown away by it because I grew up acting, dancing, and playing the drums. So it was kind of the perfect show that I had seen for myself, you know. So it kind of lit a fire into me to try to get there one day. And, you know, a few years later, you know, I went to New York, auditioned, and got the gig. So.
Well, so has it been the way you kind of imagined it to be when you were sitting in the audience when you were 17?
I mean, not really. First of all, I didn't think I'd be doing it this long.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, oh, I'm going to go to New York. I'm going to do Stomp. I'm going to go do Rent, and I'm going to do, you know, whatever. But I fell in love with it deeply. And I'm, you know, it's a way of life for me. And, it's so much more, is what I'm trying to say, than I thought it was going to be for me.
Well, so obviously, as you reference, you know, what you do on stage kind of has speaks to what you've wanted to do for a long time. But I'm curious, like, what about it has kept you doing it for so long?
A lot of it's the people that I get to work with. We have some amazing people. They manage to cast people that just really fit in together well with the show and just personalities and stuff. And I get to travel the world. I get to play music every night, which I love. That's my whole life is, you know, music is everything to me, and performing as well. And just getting to put smiles on people's faces and, yeah, just kind of inspire people as well, musically, rhythmically.
How do you try to keep it fresh? And I guess where do ideas for new, I don't know, do you call them pieces? Do you call them songs, routines? Like, where do the ideas for new ones of those come from?
Well, we have the creators of the show, Luke Cresswell, Steve McNicholas. They are based in Brighton, England, in the UK. And they have a theater there called the Old Market. And we use that space to workshop any ideas that they have. I mean, I know sometimes cast members have ideas, but most of the time, Luke, who's a genius, he just has an idea. He brings a few of us down and we'll kind of workshop it. He'll be like, oh, you know what? Stand over there or play this number or et cetera, et cetera. And he's, you know, he'll notate it. He's got stuff written out. He has sketches, you know, to where people should be standing. And then sometimes you can get involved and they, oh, how about this? So then you kind of have a part of the process, which is really cool. I don't know where he gets his inspiration from. I know that there's some things that we do, like there's a routine in the finale where we're walking on 50-gallon oil drums. Hmm. And that was based off of a nightmare he had, being chased by these, you know, almost monsters that were walking on these oil drums. So he put that in the show.
Wow. Have you been in situations where things, even though you rehearse quite a bit, things have gone wrong, where maybe somebody's thrown something to you or somebody else and you weren't expecting it, or the throw went awry, or something happened on stage that kind of threw things off and you kind of had to figure out how to make that work?
I would say probably daily. Yeah. I mean, I can tell you right now, perfect example. Last night we had opening night here in Montana. I'm in Billings right now.
Okay.
And we have this routine called Suitcases. And during the routine, those suitcases get passed around a lot. And the suitcase came to me and it was completely unzipped. And I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do, because I need to get it zipped up, backed up, but I need to play the music. So as I'm playing the music, I start zipping it back up, realizing it's not unzipped, it's broken.
Oh, geez.
So I kind of signal to the crew in the wing, and I see that he's got one ready because someone else had already told him it was broken. So I had to run off stage, grab a new one, and I made it. I came back just in time for a really change in tempo and everything part of the routine, where we jump into a circle and start throwing to each other in a circle. And I got there just in time to make it, because if I didn't, it would have screwed the whole thing up.
Wow.
So that was pretty stressful, but stuff like that happens all the time. You got to be really quick and think, you know, you got to think quick.
So we've talked about, you've been doing this for, you know, a couple of decades now. Do you envision doing this for a lot longer too?
I don't think so. I'd love to, but it has been a long time. I feel like in the next couple of years, I'll probably want to start trying to move on, just, you know, do something different. I'm a musician. I love to play drums. I play guitar and sing. I just want to be a little more involved in that. I love this show with all my heart, and I love the performance part of it. I know that when I'm done, I'll miss it. But yeah, I feel like there is a shelf life, you know, especially for your body. It's pretty hard on your body.
What is it like up on stage? I mean, you hear from musicians, you know, who sometimes describe it's kind of an electric feeling, like you can feel the stage sort of pulsating, you know, with the music. You guys are all like banging things on the stage or tapping your feet loudly to make a sound. Like, what is the sensation like when you're doing the show on stage?
I mean, it's loud, that's for sure. it's loud, but it's very focused. If you know what I mean. I mean, we're very focused, but we're also having a lot of fun. And you do feel this electricity, especially when the crowd is hot, like when they're really digging the show. It's something really special, and we all feel it. And when we have a show that's like a slamming show, you can feel it on stage. You can feel it in the air. It's like an energy. It's crazy. It's why I do it. So
you mentioned that part of what you did when you were a kid was a drummer. I'm wondering, given what you do now, were you the kind of kid who would like be sitting around and always like tapping your hand on something, like always making some kind of noise?
Yes, I was. I used to get in trouble in school for being really fidgety. And I remember finding a pair of drumsticks in my basement when I was a kid, that I guess were my mom's dad's, like my Pepe's. And I was like, oh, what are these, you know? And then I found these like vinyl suitcases that my parents had, these old suitcases. And when you hit it, it almost sounded like a bass drum.
Huh.
And then I had like a really hard like pot that I found, and I had that too. So I kind of start grooving with like a kick and snare kind of vibe with those two things. And I would add things around the basement that I found. So I'd create this little tiny setup that I had when I was a kid. And then when I was like, you know, 10 years old, I started actually playing the drums, and my parents got me a drum kit for my 12th birthday, and there you go.
So like you were kind of destined for this from a young age, it sounds like.
I guess so. I'm really happy the way it worked out.
All right. That is Andrew Patrick with Stomp. Andrew, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
You too. Thanks very much, Mark. Take it easy.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.